Who hasn't been here for any of this Revelation study that we've been doing? Hey, Barbara. Anybody else? Okay. So I'm just going to do a little quick review of what we're doing here. I'm doing a completely different take on the book of Revelation than probably any of you have ever heard before. And it's really not, I'm not approaching it from an eschatological standpoint. What eschatology means, study of the end times. And I've spent a good bit of time over the past few weeks talking about what eschatology is and why I'm not approaching this book from that standpoint. Because it's almost when Bjorn and I started doing this and going through it and how we're going to present it, Bjorn said to me, Ken, you're approaching this like almost that's just another epistle. And I said, I am, because I think it was. I think it's a very instructive book, and I think it was written in a way that we can understand it. I've spent a lot of time going through symbols and signs and pulling them out of the Old Testament and showing you how they apply into the book of Revelation. It's been fun for me. It's been a fun study for me because I actually purposely, I just set my mind not to even think about the end times and what we call the end times. And just to really do it in a way where this would be instructive and informative and give you a basis, really, for any future biblical study that you might want to do. If you understand the signs and the symbols in the book of Revelation and how they sort of pull out of the Old Testament, then you can really study almost any part of the Bible and apply those things and see how they do. We've talked about some numbers and how they repeat themselves over and over again, especially sevens and tens and fours and twos, and that they have symbolic meaning most of the time. We talked about words like clouds and how that almost never in the Bible is the word clouds used for winter weather moving in on a front, and that we've got these clouds. It talks about clouds of witnesses, clouds of people. God arrives on a glory cloud, and so it's really not an atmospheric cloud that we're talking about. It's a symbolic cloud that represents God himself and all of his witnesses and everybody coming along with him. And so if you're here for the first night, I'm going to ask your forgiveness ahead of time. I can't go back over all the things that we've gone over the last 3 weeks, but I think you'll see how some of it sort of fits in, and hopefully you'll get something out of this. Before I really dive in, I want to sort of draw back a little bit and give you just a shade of history, because at this point of the book where we're opening, we've opened up some seals and we're getting ready to hear some trumpets sound. It's important for you to know where the early church was. And I was telling Margaret, and I went on our 40th wedding anniversary. Thank you very much. And we went to Hilton Head Island, and I was able to just spend some time. We rested, and I studied and looked, and we talked. And I was telling Margaret, I would have hated to have lived back in the early church days, because there was so much persecution. There was the Roman government. And there were two major persecutions of the Christians under Nero and under Domitian. And I mean, just these are historical things that you can look up. I mean, just terrible persecutions of the Christians during those times. And then they also had persecution, the Christians did, from the Jewish leadership itself. And then within that, you know, we've looked at in the book so far where he said, those who say they're Jews and yet they're not. Who are they? People who have rejected Christ, number one, but also there was a group called Zealots. Have y'all heard about that? Them, the Zealots? They were just a warring type of people who called themselves Jews, and they actually created the war that happened around 66-68 AD when Jerusalem was completely surrounded by the armies, and Titus was the leader of those that came in, and the temple ended up being completely destroyed, completely taken down, just like Jesus said it would. Every brick and everything taken off, every stone taken down, and it happened just like he said it would happen. And the armies of Rome surrounding and these zealots were the main reason why that happened. They were attacking Rome. They claimed themselves to be the ones who needed to free up the Jews from the Roman influence, and so they created this war. So not only that, but once the armies were completely surrounding Jerusalem, then the zealots actually came in there for protection. So they're in the walls. There's a three-walled city, The Romans breached the first two walls fairly quickly, but the third wall they couldn't. And they held that. Part of the reason why they finally breached that third wall is they ran out of food. And part of the reason why they ran out of food is the zealots got mad at everybody else and burned it. So here they are trapped inside Jerusalem. The armies of Rome all around them, and these idiots burned the food. Who would do that? But they were mean. They would even, there's stories, if you read about it, where they would dress up like women, put on makeup, a long wig or whatever, and they would hide swords under their clothing, and they would go around, and then they would just rip off the clothing, pull out the sword, and just impale people and just kill them, and because they thought that's what they were supposed to do. And I don't know why, but it was mean. And so what we see is we see a constant competition over all of history of evil versus a righteousness. You know, when God sets a standard, when God sets that standard out and you have a standard of purity and righteousness, evil cannot coexist with that. And evil will always fail. And this is really in the crux of the message of the book of Revelation. He says, for those of you who have been here for the whole thing, our theme through the first sevens was the seven churches in Asia Minor. And he said, persevere. He said, hang in there. Don't give up. Don't deny me. You know, and then you won't be denied before the Father. Hang in there. Because why are they hanging in there? Because they have all this evil around them, all this persecution around them, everything that's happened around them. And they just, it's hard. I mean, that we in the United States don't understand what it takes to stand up for something like that. You know, don't deny your faith. Right now, over in the Middle East, the Muslims are gathering up the Christians, and they're trying to make them denounce their Christian faith. You know, that happened in Rome, where Nero burned Christians at the stake at night just to provide light. Nero, how many ever heard the thing, Rome burned while Nero fiddled, right? Well, the story is that Nero, they wanted to accuse Nero of causing this fire in Rome that burned a significant section of the center of the whole city. But history says that he wasn't even there. He was somewhere else. But he got accused. Nobody liked Nero. Nobody likes evil people. They didn't like Nero, and they hated Domitian. They killed him too, finally. After he killed a whole bunch of other people, they killed him too. But evil cannot continue to coexist. It just won't be there. It will finally fail. And this is the message of the book of Revelation. And he goes through these stories, and he says, you know, when you see words like the beast came up out of the sea, you know, things like that, what is a beast? A beast can be a person with just an evil spirit in them. Just evilness is a beast. The serpent of old was a beast. Satan in the Garden of Eden was a beast. That same spirit in a man is a beast, and especially if he's a ruler of Rome or whatever, you know, major country. You know, we need good rulers. And I'm going to show you an example when we get, this is just a little teaser, but we're going to finish up with the number 666. And I'm going to show you a story of a man who God thought a lot about, but he had a problem with 666. And I'm going to show that to you in the Old Testament. I'm going to show you how it applies in the book of Revelation. And it has nothing to do with barcodes, helicopters, all that kind of stuff. Just throw that out of your mind. Microchips. I don't think John knew what a microchip was back then. Near field communication, nothing like that. So we actually got to opening up the seventh seal, and what we said was that the seventh seal is really a prelude to opening up the trumpets. So in chapter 7, and I'm not going to read a lot of this like I did before. I've spent so much time going through symbols and images I'm going to try to fly through this. We're going to try to get all the way to chapter 13. So if you have questions after we get done, we have time, I'll go back and try to answer those for you. But it sees four angels, and these four angels are standing at the four corners of the earth. Anybody remember what I said the number four generally stands for in the Bible? Earth, right. So when you're the mercy seat and the four corners, the square mercy seat that was in the Holy of Holies in the Old Testament, that really represents us and the earth. And so you have four angels standing over the earth, right? And he says, saw another angel coming out of the east. Now, so we see a description, and we say, well, who is that angel coming out of the east? Well, he's carrying the seal of the living God, and he shouts out those four angels who had been given power to injure the land, say, wait, don't hurt them. So anytime you see the word see, think separation from God. Just think that word, just think of that. In some cases, it actually represents the Gentiles. In some cases, it just represents an abyss, something that's separate from God. The land, as a general rule, remember the very first week I said Israel was always judged by what? Their land. God would push them out of the land. He would take their land away from them. What did he promise them? What was the promised land, right? He promised them a land with milk and honey, and that they would be there. And, you know, and had they continued to abide in his promises and persevere and do his will, they would have stayed there all the time. But they didn't always choose to do that. So we've got, we've got these four angels, and they're waiting to be released. And who controls everything? God does. Who has the keys to death, hell, and the grave? He's already taken them, right? He's in control of all of this. If there's angels to be released, it's not Satan that gets to say when those angels are being released and when they're not. So just keep that in mind. So, and he says, wait, don't hurt the land or the sea. So don't hurt the Gentiles. Don't hurt the Jews. Just hold off now. Or the trees. Trees generally represent people. And as a general rule, they represent righteous people, saved people, those that have the seal of God on their foreheads. He said, wait until we place the seal of God on the foreheads of his servants. And then he goes through and he talks about the 144,000. This is the first time when we've seen that. 144,000, we talked about 12s and multiples of 12s being governments and really representing the church. The 12 disciples, the 12 tribes of Israel. So, and then tens has been, multiples of tens has been quantitative completeness. So 144,000 basically represents a completeness of the whole church and the government of the church. So they're all being sealed. He said, wait until we're all sealed before we release those four angels. And he says, he sees this vast crowd, too great to count, from every nation and tribe and people and language. This, you're going to start seeing this repeat through too. Who is God's chosen people? Israelites, Jewish people, right. But what happened? Where did the Gentiles come in? And how did all that take place? How did we get grafted in? It's easy. It's a Jesus question. We did through what happened, the sacrifice on the Christ, of Christ on the cross. So when we get grafted in, now he's talking about every nation, every tribe, every tongue. And you'll see as we go through here, he talks about a mystery, that there's a mystery that's been revealed in the cross. And we can look in Ephesians chapter 3, and we can very easily see what that mystery is. It's not a mystery as if it's something that nobody knows and you have to be this diviner to figure it out. It's a mystery of something that just was unknown and now is revealed. In chapter 3 of Ephesians, if you read that, you'll find out the mystery is that the Gentiles are grafted in. That's the mystery of God, that we're all accepted. And this whole book, if you just read through this book and don't think helicopters and barcodes and things and start thinking, what's he talking about? He's talking about a battle, a spiritual battle and a physical battle. He's talking about a battle that, and there is a spiritual battle that has been waged, is being waged, and will continue to be waged, but Christ has conquered. He talks of it, he shows him as a conquering angel, one with the seven stars is in his right hand, remember? He's got control of everything. He's clothed in righteousness, a sharp two-edged sword that goes out of his mouth. And we talked about that two-edged sword and how it cuts both ways. There is salvation, but there's also judgment. And he really doesn't have to judge, because if you just separate from him, then you're automatically under judgment. You've judged yourself. Your choice. He doesn't take away our free choice. So that's really the theme, and it's a theme that I've been developing for the past 3 weeks to show you, and I'm just going to give you another heads up that you can look ahead at these next two sevens, and what you find out at the end of the sevens, at the end of both of them, Jesus wins. At the end of both sevens, he talks about all these terrible things that are going to be released from the abyss, and these locusts and everything that comes out, and all this happens. And but at the very seventh thing is, that we have Christ and Jesus wins. It's a spiritual battle, and we're living in a physical world. We're living in a world where there are people who are beastly. There are people who are evil. There is evil in this world. But the only thing that defeats evil is a standard of righteousness, a standard that God sets that can't be, it just can't be compromised. And that's why he said persevere. He used that word over and over, persevere. You hear the wrath of God. You see that word wrath in the Old Testament. You see it in the book of Revelation. And the whole thing is that he's talking about a wrath that does come upon you. If you want a wrath to come on you, separate yourself from God. Just walk away and say, I'm not going to do this anymore, and see how well your life lives, and see how comfortable you are. And I'm going to get to that 666, and I'm going to love to show you this example out of the Old Testament of how that 666 comes into play in my life and in your life. So where we are here. So a great multitude, and it says salvation comes from where? God, and on the throne from the Lamb. This is the seventh thing. They're opening the seventh seal, and here it is. He wins. He wins here, and he wins in the next two seventh things that happen. In the end, he still wins. There's a spiritual battle that he is conquering, has conquered, is conquering, and will continue to conquer. It's absolutely conquered. We don't have to really worry about it. We can study about all the rest of the stuff, or we can just concentrate on all the sevens where he's conquered. So, and that's pretty much it. Now, this the eighth chapter, I used to make a joke about the first verse of the eighth chapter, and I'll tell you what the joke was, and you don't have to laugh at it, because I'm a reformed person now, and I don't tell these kind of jokes. But I used to go up to somebody and say, hey, you know how I know there's no women in heaven? They said, yeah, because Revelation 8:1 says, and there was silence in heaven for about the space of a half an hour. Now, I didn't tell that joke, you understand? That's not me. I'm not telling that joke anymore. So, oh, did I? Men got there an hour and a half before the women did. Okay. But, you know, anytime you see a space of silence, man, how would you like to be sitting there waiting on God to say something and just pure silence? I mean, he is getting ready to lay it down, and he says, okay, everybody just calm down. I have this under control. And we see that in the sevens as we go through this. So the seventh seal actually begins the seven trumpets. And, you know, and he talks about the seven angels. I think these are the same seven angels. He talked about the seven angels over the seven churches. He keeps talking about these seven angels. You know, I said that angels also can be translated as bishops, and they were over the churches. But there's also spiritual control over the churches as well. And so I think it's the same seven angels, because he keeps talking about the seven angels. Have seven trumpets, and they, you know, and they're getting ready to sound off with the trumpets. So, let me get my phone open here, because I can read it easier on my phone than I can. Let's see, Revelation chapter 8. And so the first trumpet, it says vegetation was struck. The first angel sounded, and hail and fire followed, mingled with blood, and they were thrown into the earth. A third of the trees burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. You know, we've gone from the seals where a fourth was killed or whatever, to now we're going to thirds. And I said before last week, in my opinion, a third is just very short of spirituality. Three is God's number, the Trinity. You know, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. You know, when you see threes, you start thinking about God and His Son and the Holy Spirit. When you see thirds, you know, it's one of those things where it's just not up to the spiritual level that God would have. So, but and when the trees are affected and the grass is affected, that really is the righteous people aren't spared from what happens in this physical world. You know, we talk about escaping tribulation. You know, I think tribulation was back then. I think tribulation has been, and I think tribulation is now, and I think tribulation will continue to be. I don't think there's a person in here that doesn't go through some level of tribulation virtually your whole life. I mean, and you know, that's why Ralph Martin stand up here and he talked about your attitude and how you approach it. Why do you have to approach everything with the whole premise that God is in control and nothing bad happens in my world? why do you have to approach it from that if there's nothing bad that happens in your world? And the fact is that we're all going through tribulation, sometimes through great tribulation. And yet, the seventh trumpet and the seventh bowl and the seventh everything, Jesus still wins. So the second trumpet, the seas are struck. You know, and seas, you know, represent the Gentile nations. And the sea became blood. A third of the sea became blood. It says a great mountain was thrown in. Mountains, you know, the Old Testament talks about Israel being God's burning mountain. The glory of God being on the mountain. And a mountain's thrown into the sea. Part of this is letting them know that there's basically a changing. This book is a revelation of a new covenant. There was an old covenant. Now there's a new covenant. The Gentiles are grafted in. This old mountain is thrown into the sea, and now there's a new mountain. There's a new Jerusalem. There's a newness here that says that you and I are in, and all we have to do is accept that. So then the third trumpet, the waters are struck, and a lot of these you can almost imagine in your mind if you've read the plagues of Egypt. There's some similarity to these, you know, the rivers being struck and the plagues and the locusts and all those things. It's imagery that's coming out of the Old Testament. What he's telling them is that there's judgment. There was judgment against Egypt because they wouldn't let the Israelites go. And there's judgment against those who persecute the Christians now. It may not be manifested right now, but it is a judgment and it will be manifested. So the fourth is the heavens struck, and it talks about a third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, a third of the stars. And for those of you that haven't been here until now, anytime we see moon, sun, and stars, then you start thinking about leaders. And I gave an example in the Old Testament where Joseph went to his father and said, "I had a dream, and the sun, the moon, and 11 stars bowed down to me." He knew what that meant. He said, "No, son, I'm not. Mother and I are not bowing down to you. I don't think you got that right. Might better go back and redream something." But that's not what happened. They ended up bowing down to him. And so, when you see sun, moon, and stars, darkness struck. It's really what I call de-creation or recreation. So what he's saying is, these are the elements of creation. We're taking those down. We had the old way of doing things with animal sacrifices and everything in the temple, and now we're switching it over, and now you've got this new thing. We had one complete, full sacrifice, and that was his son on the cross. And once that's done, it's done. So and you see words in the book of Revelation when he talks about it, he says, "It is done." On the cross, Jesus said, it is finished. When you're reading in Revelation, and I'm not reading every word to you, but you read through those things, and what you see is a point there where he says, "It is done." Jesus is here. It's done. It's over. The spiritual battle is won. You and I have to live in a physical realm. The question is, how do we persevere through that physical realm? And then we get Ralph Martin back in here to tell us how to do it again. So that's it. Let's see where we are. The fifth trumpet, locusts from the bottomless pit. A star fell from heaven to the earth, and to him was given the key to the bottomless pit. Who has the key? Who's in control? All right, so if he released it, he released it. And it's just an acknowledgement that we live in a world where there is evil, and we have to abide with that at times. You're going to see, as we go on through here, and I'm just really talking because I don't want to go through and read everything in here, but we get to a point where it talks about witnesses. There were two witnesses it talks about, and there were two major witnesses in the Old Testament. There are more than two, but there were two major witnesses in the Old Testament, two major witnesses in the New Testament. Old Testament, Moses and Elijah. New Testament, John the Baptizer. I'm not going to say John the Baptist. John the Baptizer and Jesus. John was killed and Jesus was killed. It talks about him being killed and laying out. My two witnesses are going to be killed and laid out and not buried. And then what happens? Whoops, they rise from the dead. You know, so he's giving them these images that they will totally understand. In their day and time, they totally understand these images, and they understand that there is a spiritual battle and there's a physical battle. He's asking them from the very beginning of the first seven, he's saying, persevere. Through the next seven, he's saying, these things are going to happen, but don't give up hope and don't ever turn away. Persevere, because if you persevere, then your name's in the book of life. And, you know, even towards the end, we'll see there, you know, he talks about your name being in the book of life or not being in the book of life. It's up to you to really decide that. It's not up to him. And the judgment has already been made depending on where you choose to be. I mean, it's really pretty simple. I mean, Christianity's a pretty simple, pretty simple religion. You know, so it's really not that difficult. You know, he talks about, a third, and then it gets down to the torment of the scorpion. And we talked about astronomy and how there were stargazers. How did they find Jesus, remember? Star, follow the star. They're stargazers. That's part of their culture. And so Scorpio, this tail of Scorpio pointed to a third of the rest of the constellations. You know, and in chapter 12, if you read through that, it talks about the tail sweeping a third of the stars out of the sky. And maybe exactly a 33rd percent of the angels fell. I don't know. A lot of them apparently fell with Satan. But, you know, but this is an imagery where Scorpio wipes out a third of them. And those stars fall, and they're fallen angels. And they're, the Lucifer. And then you see words in here like, Abaddon and whatever those words are, you can just erase those words and put the word destroyer in there, because that's what they translate to mean. There are destroyers, there are beasts, there are people who have evil spirits, and we live in a world with those people, and sometimes good people die, and I don't know the answer to why that has to happen, but it does. But God is a lot more concerned about your spiritual well-being than he is about whether some Christians get martyred or not. And I'm not saying he doesn't care that they're martyred. He does. The righteousness does always prevail. But I am saying that the spiritual battle is where you either win or lose. That's where Christ has already conquered. You got anything you want to add up to this point? Spencer? You got any wisdom? You've taught it twice. Did they like it? Yeah. Did they accept it from this standpoint? Yeah. That's great. That's good stuff. You want to come here and preach? Yeah. Now you're going to go back and tell that joke, aren't you? Yeah. So you know, in chapter 12, the woman and the seventh trumpet brings the third terror. But the 24 elders sitting on the thrones before God, fell on their faces and worshiped. It's because the seventh angel blew his trumpet. There were loud voices shouting, the whole world has now become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he will reign forever and ever. And then it says, they fall down and say, we give thanks to you, Lord God Almighty, the one who is, who always was, for now you have assumed your great power and have begun to reign. They're talking about Jesus here. That's what I'm saying. In the seventh thing, Jesus wins. The spiritual battle is done. And so all we have to accept it. Chapter 12 is really just a summation of all history. In the beginning was God, and the God was there, and a third of the angels fell. And so, and then there was the woman, and she had gave birth. You know, generally speaking, that woman is the church. And so, you know, and there was a dragon waiting to take her child. And, you know, it's the same theme. The book of Revelation is no different theme-wise than the whole rest of the Bible. And when we start trying to make it, stop trying to make it something that it really isn't, it starts coming alive and makes a whole lot of sense. You know, and a beast comes out of the sea, So we have this beast with seven heads and ten horns. I've seen different things assigned to that. Ten horns always represents power. You know, there's ten horns and there's seven heads, and written on each of them were names that blaspheme God. So this is a terrible beast. It's a beast trying to imitate God in his tens and his powers, and it comes up out of the sea. And you know, and we talk about Antichrist. How many people have heard the word Antichrist? How many times is the word Antichrist found in the book of Revelation? Everybody raise your hand and tell me. Mark's got it. How many? Zero. You will not find Antichrist. How many times is the word? I'm not going to go there. Should I? Don't get me fired up. Okay, so the word Antichrist does appear in the Bible. Anybody know where it is? 1 John. And it's talking about, what it says is, if you deny Christ, if you do anything that's against Christ, then you're an Antichrist. Anybody who has that spirit is an Antichrist. It's not like that there's one specific Antichrist. And this thing about mark on the head and the mark on the hand, you know, even in the Old Testament, they talk about people being marked on the head and the hand, but that's really what you think and what you do. So how you think and the things that you do define who you are, because that's what's coming out of you. He says, persevere. You want the mark of the beast? Then think like the beast and do the things the beast does and be evil, and you'll be just like the beast if that's what you want to be. Or you can have the seal of God. In this case, seal of God is the same thing as a mark. You can have that on your forehead, and you can have it on your hand and do the things that he wants you to do, and you'll come out a whole lot better. What you think, Joey? Good? Okay. You're shaking your head. You got something you want to add here? Okay. All right. Anybody has any questions or anything you want to throw out? I'm good with it. I'm just giving you what's in me. So this beast, you know, and then he talks about, where are we? Yeah, chapter 13. So may get done a little early today because I'm just trying to blow through some of this. The beast comes out of the earth. He says, he required everyone, great and small, rich and poor, slave and free, to be given the mark on the right hand or on the forehead. And no one could buy or sell anything without that mark, which was either the name of the beast or the number representing his name. What did Jesus say about the money when they said, you're going to pay your taxes? And he pulls out the coin and he says what? Whose image is on that coin? Caesar's. He said, give to Caesar what's Caesar's, but give to God what's God's. And that's really the whole, you know, Jesus could sum things up pretty simply, couldn't he? I mean, that was pretty simple. And he says, wisdom is needed to understand this. Let the one who has understanding solve the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666. There are different things that are said about that 666, even amongst biblical scholars. Some people take it as the six being one short of God's number, seven, and that it's man's number. And I think that may be part of it. And some people say it was Nero Caesar's name, because the name Nero Caesar, if you took the Hebrew letters of it and assigned the numerical values to each number, to each letter of that, and add them up, they come up to 666. So, and Nero Caesar was a terrible guy. I don't know if I finished that story, but he crucified, he killed Christians. He would put animal skins on them and throw them out and let the dogs rip them up. And he would do that to try, because they were accusing him of things, he would turn around and accuse the Christians of doing it. Christians were an easy scapegoat. Pretty docile religion, after all. I mean, what's the main crux? What was in the very first church at Ephesus? What did he tell them that they'd fallen from? Their first love. He says, go back to your first love. Don't forget about the love. Once, if we as Christians leave that, if we leave that love, then everything else is what? A clanging symbol or something. I mean, he sort of addresses that in First Corinthians. And so you know, the whole thing is that 666 can mean a lot of different things. But here's the point that I want to get across to you about 666. There's two places in the Old Testament say exactly the same thing. You can write it down. First Kings 10:14. in 2 Chronicles 9:13. And this is a story about Solomon. Who's heard of Solomon? Has anybody not heard of Solomon? Was he a wise man? Absolutely. He wrote the book of Proverbs, right? And was he a great leader? You think so? He did what? Married for. Okay, we're getting to that. So was he a good leader? I mean, we generally think he probably was by knowing Solomon's name and hearing Solomon and the temple and everything else. 666 in the Old Testament, the only place you'll find associated with is Solomon. And it says at the height of his power, at the height of his glory, at the height of when he was in control in office, he was making 666 talents of gold per year in addition to whatever came in through shipping and trade. He was amassing amazing amounts of wealth, gold, silver, but he violated the three laws that God said a leader should not violate. Number one, don't amass gold and silver for yourself. Number two, don't amass horses for yourself. In other words, the armies, you get all these great armies, all of a sudden you don't depend on me anymore. Don't amass horses for yourself. And number three is don't amass wives and women for yourself. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines, according to history. I don't know how he did that. I have trouble with one. I was in surgery today, and I was talking to my surgery tech about something, and we got into what I call a little verbal tussle. It had nothing to do with the surgery. We were just passing time at that point in time. And finally I said, Kendra, I concede. I can't win. I can't beat one woman. I know I can't beat however many ever come along. So you win the argument. She said, "Well, I knew I'd already won before I even started." You know, so you know, I don't know how Solomon did that, but he also wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. And Margaret and I were talking about this on sitting on the beach, tough life, you know, sitting on the beach talking about Solomon. And I know Joey read this book because I saw him post it, but Margaret was reading a book called Satisfied. And she said, look in the book of Ecclesiastes, because at the end of his life, at the end of Solomon's life, he came to a different, totally different conclusion. And he said, all those things that I amassed didn't do me any good. It's like chasing the wind. He said, fear God and keep his commandments, and then all will be well with you. So this, you know, we can assign whatever value we want to 666, but I can tell you that if you're amassing 666 talents of gold and you violate God's laws, that will not go well with you. You want to associate yourself with earthly things and with the beast and with his mark and the things that he does, things won't go well with you. But if you associate yourself with God and his things and abide by his laws, Solomon came back around, and yeah, he was a good leader. You know, David fell too. You know, that the only one that didn't sin was Jesus. So I'm not going to say Solomon wasn't a great leader. I'm going to tell you he made some mistakes. But he realized his mistakes, and he repented of them, and he came back. And that's what we get through Christ. That's what we get is constant availability of forgiveness. It's really our choice. So I kept you a long time one week, and this week I determined I wasn't going to read every verse and go back and read everything in the Old Testament and bore you to get to death again. But I hope you can see, and we'll do the next seven next week, which is the seven chalices or bowls of judgments that are poured out. And again, I'm giving you the advanced thing. Read number seven first if you want to. Jesus wins there too. And then we'll talk about, and probably Pastor will be involved in this last one because he loves the 21st chapter of the book of Revelation. But, you know, it that's what's there for us. There's a newness that's available for all of us once we get past this persevering thing and get away from the judgment thing, which, I'll give you one little heads up, God's not going to have to judge. We've already put ourselves in position. And we're either judged or we're not. We're either in that book of life or we're not. And just because we sin, just like Solomon, doesn't mean we're kicked out of that book of life. But it does mean we may need to repent from something. Pastor.
That's good, Ken. That's good.
I got that text.
Sunday morning, we're going to do how we view three things determines our life. And it's how we view sin, how we view the devil, and how we view people. And one of the things, and I want to bring out Revelation 12, because it really shows where Satan really is, how we should really look at him, and how that we live in a Bible Belt, which is good. I'm not condemning the Bible Belt. It's done some awesome things. But because of the Bible Belt, there's a lot of things. It's how we approach the book of Revelation is not the way most of the people in the Bible Belt approach the book of Revelation. But you can't, don't define all of Christianity just by the Bible Belt. There's a whole big world out there. What Ken has taught and what I've just heard that Spencer taught in the Presbyterian Church is what thousands of people teach and have a different viewpoint. And when you see that 666, and Solomon had so much time to repent. The one thing that, we talk a lot about the mercies of God, and we always will, because he is a very merciful God. But, he says he is slow to wrath. He's so slow. And because that number 666 is like, there's a fullness of evil that reaches a point, and God says, that's it. That's it. You're going to reap the consequences of that. He's not the God that's going to, you start going down a wrong path, he's not going to come down, and you're not going to suffer any consequences from that. But if you continue to do that, there'll come a time, that consequences, not like God's going to bring down wrath on you. We bring it on ourselves because we choose to go down a road. But he is so long-suffering. He says, I'm going to give you time. And Solomon had all this time to repent. And all the other people in scriptures, and time again. And aren't you glad we have served such a merciful God that is slow and gives us time? I found out in relationships, if you just give people time, they'll probably change. They really will. If you're not quick to point the finger and quick to, just give them time to deal with their relationship with God, and it'll most people will work out. They'll find themselves turning. So that's all I really got to say about that. But any questions? Anybody have any questions? Comments? It's not too late, though. It's not too late to learn. Penny? Can be, and that's why we really chose through our conversations not to be combative, was the word we wanted to use, and argumentative. The last time Ken taught this, and I taught some, and Mike Oliver taught some, we were a little combative and argumentative in it, if you were here. Yeah. And we've mellowed in our older age, and we're not as combative. We don't want to fight them battles anymore. So we chose not to be combative. I will get still a little bit if you were. Raise me up a little bit. I'll try not to be. But